Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
If you've got a Bible, we're going to be in Matthew 11. And you guys know I like to do a little more casual on Sunday night, not just in dress, but in the way I present my lessons. And I want to talk a little bit about how I arrived at doing this lesson from Matthew 11. My plan this week had been to do the last lesson of the Why Should I Believe series. And those lessons they take a long time to prepare because they're very, very slide heavy. And this week I started two new series. I started Hebrews and I started John. And besides the amount of work that goes into just studying for the lesson itself, which is quite a bit, because it's the first one, there's creating graphics and slide templates and all of that stuff that goes along with it. And this morning's lesson, at least for a Sunday morning lesson, had a lot of slides for me. I don't usually do a ton of slides. And I don't know, there's probably a dozen this morning. And so by the time I got through with Hebrews and I got through with John, I was like, I'm not going to have enough time to do a full Why Should I Believe lesson that usually has more like 30 or 40 slides. I'm not going to have time to do all that. Well, in the midst of all that, I was going through my library, if you will, of notes that I have on lessons. I pretty much have the notes of every lesson I have ever taught. That was one of the benefits of having been a computer guy, is that I prefer digital. And from the very beginning, I prepared my lessons on a computer. I could store them on a computer. I didn't have to keep up with a piece of paper. And again, I can go all the way back to the mid-90s of lessons that I have, you know, notes that I've prepared. Well, I was in that filing system that I have, and I noticed something that I honestly didn't know that I had. There was a teacher at Bellevue, and I mentioned him one other time before. His name was Rex Roberts. Rex passed away in 2024. Rex was a great teacher. I think he was, during his professional life, was an attorney, but had been a teacher in the church for a long time. And after his retirement, he not only taught regularly on normal worship services, but even did a Tuesday morning class every week for years and years and years. Well, I was always teaching, so I didn't go through all of Rex's classes. But if I was ever not teaching on a Sunday morning or a Wednesday night, and he was teaching, he was one of those teachers that I sought out. And I mentioned him here. I don't expect anybody to remember this, but I went through his class where he did a study of how we got the Bible. I think I mistakenly said it was based on Gordon Lightfoot's book. It was really Neil Lightfoot, not the singer Gordon Lightfoot. But it was based on Neil Lightfoot's book, and I liked that study so much, I asked Rex if I could have his notes. And so he gave me a thumb drive with his notes on it. And I had forgotten this part, though. After that, as he would finish studies, he would, whether I was in the class or not, he would bring me his notes from his studies. So I have this library of Rex Roberts' notes of studies that I never went through with him. And I just happened to be, I don't even know how I ended up in there, but I was browsing in it this week. And I saw this one that said, "Lessons from My Favorite Passages." And I was like, I wonder what his favorite passages were. And so I pulled it up, and his notes are immaculate. I mean, they're so well organized. He always put them together to be put in a binder, because all of his folks in his Tuesday class had binders, and he would had like a title sheet and a chapter, table of contents. And what makes it easy for me, I just go look up, you know, he had questions at the end of each lesson and then a whole separate document with the answers to the questions. So anyway, I just looked. I was like, I wonder what his favorite verses were. And I looked at the very first one. It was this one, Matthew 11, 28 through 30. And he called it in his notes, the Great Invitation. I don't know that I had ever heard it referred to that way or not. Maybe that's what everybody calls it. I had not heard to it referred to by that phrase. But it piqued my interest. And I read through his notes. What I'm about to preach is not a lesson directly from his notes. I have a hard time putting myself in someone else's shoes because my teaching style is not like Rex's teaching style was. Rex was a great teacher, but we're different. And so this is not an attempt to try to preach that lesson, but just it brought that passage to the front of my mind. And that's, again, I thought it feels kind of random, but that's how it happened this week. That's how it happened. And as I started thinking about the passage and I read through Rex's notes, and for some reason I started thinking, because he had that written as the Great Invitation, I started thinking about receiving an invitation in the mail to something. You know, maybe you receive an invitation to a wedding, you receive an invitation to graduation party or a fundraising dinner or whatever it is. And there's things that are on that invitation that are on every invitation, right? You'll have, you know, who it's from, right? Who it's to. What's the invitation? I mean, what are you being invited to do, right? Sometimes there'll be in there an RSVP, which is abbreviation for a French phrase, respond, s'il vous plaît, asking for you to respond whether you're going to come or not, and there'll be instructions on how you RSVP. And sometimes things you get invited to will say, hey, and we're going to have, you know, and there's some attempt to have a hook to get you to accept the invitation. We're going to have some special speaker. We're going to give out a free, we're going to have door prizes. We're going to have whatever. You know, you guys have received invitations. You know, they come in all shapes and sizes, but they have some of that same basic information, all of them. And for some reason, that's what kept holding in my brain as I was thinking about this invitation that Jesus gives. And just simply, I mean, let's just read it. Matthew 11, 28 through 30. I'm reading from the English Standard as I usually do. But he says, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, you guys know me. I'm not going to jump headfirst in any passage without first talking about the context. I just don't do it. And with this passage, this is one of those that's real easy to take off the page and kind of hold it out on its own, right? I mean, it's a great passage. It's comforting in the sense of who it's addressed to and what it's offering, okay? But I think it has even a lot more meaning when you understand the broader context. And even so much to think about, where was Jesus in his ministry? You know, we started on Sunday morning the Gospel of John, and we're going to work through John. John is very different than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I loved it. One year, may have been 2 years ago, on our summer series, we had Les Chapman from Hendersonville, who had previously been at Northside. And he referred to John as the Paul Harvey gospel, the rest of the story. I love that. Because John's is unlike the other ones. There's no attempt to be chronological. There's no attempt to have it in narrative order. It's really just kind of from scene to scene to scene to scene to scene. Focusing on miracles and conversations, really. Well, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we refer to those as the synoptic gospels. And there's some of that that's not chronological. But it also reads much more like a narrative that has where you can see the progression of the ministry of Jesus. And if you think about in the Gospel of Matthew, real quickly, I'm going to go back to chapter 4. Say, oh no, Tim, don't try to preach from 4 through 11. I'll go through it quick. I finished early, so I got to make up for that tonight. Right, Jeremy?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, Jesus' ministry begins in Matthew 4. It begins in Matthew 4. It comes right after his baptism. His baptism by John the Baptist. I alluded to that in the sermon this morning. One of the times when you can see all three members of the Godhead in the same section of Scripture. Jesus is baptized. He's tempted. And then he moves to Galilee to begin his ministry, right? What was his true hometown? It was Nazareth. But in chapter 4, and you guys correct me if I say any of this wrong, because I'm not looking at the text. I'm trying to do a summary from memory here, because I'll be faster if I sit there and try to flip through the pages. But I believe it's in Matthew 4 when he moves to Capernaum. And Capernaum becomes his adopted hometown. By the way, they're still very proud of that even today. You walk into Capernaum, the ruins of Capernaum today, and it says the hometown of Jesus. Magnificent ruins there, by the way. One of my favorite places to go is Capernaum. But he moved to Capernaum on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee and began his, what we might refer to as his Galilean ministry. And here's where we're going to fast forward. We're going to have like a montage scene here. When you go from chapters 5 through chapter 9, okay, 5 through 7 is the Sermon on the Mount, okay? We know the Sermon on the Mount. Where did the Sermon on the Mount take place? It took place in Galilee. Exactly where, we don't know, but it was on a mountain or a hill in Galilee. Today in Israel, there is a mountain they call the Mount of Beatitudes. That's not its actual name, but where they say it happened. But we don't know exactly where it happened. It happened on a mountain, probably on the north side of Galilee. And then after that sermon, some might call it the greatest sermon of all time, but after that sermon, the scriptures from chapters, that ends at 7, so 8, 9, chapters 8 and 9 are filled with miracle after miracle after miracle after miracle in Galilee. They're in Galilee. That's part of his ministry. You know, in Hebrews, we'll talk about how in chapter 2, the Hebrew writer talks about how God used mighty works, first through Jesus, then through the disciples of Jesus, to give credibility to who Jesus was, right? Peter in Acts 2 said that God attested to him by signs and wonders, right? It was to show that he was the Christ. So Jesus, going throughout Galilee, is performing all of these miracles and teaching about the kingdom. I understand you guys studied about the kingdom this morning. Yeah. Yeah, I want to read that chapter, by the way, in that book. But he's teaching about the kingdom, okay? And he's doing miracles to give credibility to who he was, right? And we won't go through all the miracles. And then in chapter 10... you have the calling of the 12, the apostles, the disciples who become his apostles here on the earth, and not just the calling of them. And you could look at it as maybe this is a summarization of the calling, because he had previously called Matthew, because Matthew was a tax collector, I believe in Capernaum. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. But Matthew was a tax collector. He had already called Matthew, recorded in the text. But a summary of the calling of the 12, and then a sending out of the 12. You just read all of chapter 10. That's what all of it is about, right? And then you come to chapter 11. I told you it'd be fast. We come to chapter 11, and the first thing is John is sending messengers to ask if Jesus is really the Christ. And we could debate that about what he was really asking. But he asks that question, and Jesus gives an answer that involves even tell them of the works that you've seen. Again, Jesus has been performing mighty works, okay? But then I want you to call your attention to what comes next. What comes next? Because if you go down to verse 20, there's this very interesting passage that really only makes sense within the context. And that is that Jesus has been active in ministering to the cities of Galilee, right? He has been teaching, he's living and teaching and performing miracles in Galilee. And then he says this, woe to you, or sorry, then he began to denounce the cities where most of his mighty works had been done. Again, chapters 8 and 9 filled with mighty work after mighty work after mighty work after mighty work. It says he began to denounce the cities where most of his mighty works had been done because they did not repent. You catch that? Did Jesus know what it was to be disappointed? Did Jesus know what it was to not have success in planting his own seed? Did Jesus know what that felt like? Of course he did. And he says, woe to you, Chorazin, city of Galilee. Woe to you, Bethsaida, city of Galilee. For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, two cities of the Phoenicians that had not yet been evangelized. Okay? He says, if the works done to you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes, brings to mind the people of Nineveh. He says, if the gospel had made it there, they would have repented in mourning for their sins. But I tell you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for Tyre and Sidon than for you. He says, it'd be more bearable for those who have not heard the word than for you who have seen these mighty works and have rejected. And then he says, and you, Capernaum, oh, his adopted hometown. So where he lived. By the way, where Peter's mother-in-law lived too. Maybe even Peter lived. People of Capernaum, the folks that run the site in Capernaum sure want you to think, make you think that Peter lived there. But you, Capernaum, will you be exalted to heaven? You will be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Sodom. Oh, we know about Sodom, right? We studied about Abraham. Remember we did that long study on the life of Abraham. What did God do to Sodom? He burned it to the ground, right? It would have remained until this day. He says, if the mighty works done amongst you had been done there, the city would still be here. And he says, I tell you, it will be more tolerable in the day of judgment for the land of Sodom than for you. And so Jesus has experienced this incredible disappointment that his ministry, backed up by these incredible miracles. You know, you think about, just think about, one of the ones is the centurion. The centurion who comes to him with a servant is sick, and the centurion said, hey, you don't even have to come. You can make him well from where you are. And Jesus had the power to do that. And they see these things happening. And they rejected him. So Jesus is, he's been rejected. He's feeling disappointment. He's feeling burdened. He's feeling burdened. Okay? And then I want you to look at what comes right before the invitation. What becomes right before the invitation is a prayer. Okay? It's a prayer. And the prayer, by the way, makes way more sense when you read about the disappointment. Because what is the disappointment based on? It's based on, back to verse 20, says he done mighty works, but they did not repent. Now listen to the prayer. I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth. By the way, you see two members of the Godhead there. Son is praying to the Father. I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things. What things? The things he has been teaching. The gospel, the message of the kingdom. I thank you that you have hidden these things from the wise and understanding and revealed them to little children. Now, do you think about what that means? Those who are wise and understanding, I think what Jesus is implying here is that those who live as though they have everything figured out. Because those who believe they have everything figured out are not seeking something else. You with me? If you think you've got it all that you need, if you think you've got it all figured out, you're not going to look for anything else, right? What is the explanation for why these folks in these Galilean cities saw these mighty works and yet just turned away from them? They didn't feel like they needed it, right? They felt self-sufficient. They were, as I believe we all inherently are born to believe, that we need to put the weight of the world on our own shoulders, right? We'll figure this out on our own. But he's coming out of that disappointment, he thanks God. God, thank you for not giving this message to those who don't believe they need it. Those are my words, interpreted. But he says, but have revealed them to little children. Now later in Matthew, I think Matthew 18, correct me if I'm wrong on that, Jesus will use a child as an object lesson. The disciples are arguing about who's the greatest, and what does Jesus say? Unless you humble yourself like this child. And we can talk about a lot of characteristics about children. But children have, they need everything. They can do nothing on their own. The children are the most receptive to looking for help from the outside because they've not been conditioned to believe that they don't need anybody. Quite the opposite. As a small child, they believe they need everything, right? They know, I mean, that's what... You cry when you need food. You cry when you need mama. You cry when you're dirty. You cry, right? You're asking for help constantly, right? And so he says, hey, Lord, thank you that you have entrusted this message to the little children. Again, I believe it's to those who are humble enough to know that they need something beyond themselves. You with me? You with me? And he says, yes, Father, for such was your gracious will. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father. And no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. By the way, this is not John's gospel, but I think this right here is the very reason why John called Jesus the Logos. Because he is the one through whom we can know the Father. He has revealed the Father to us. Okay? Now, that's the context of the, as Rex called it in his notes, the great invitation. Okay? The great invitation. Because it comes in the very next verse. Prayer and then invitation. And we don't know who's in the audience, who he's talking to. Except that we know who he invites. Now, I want to go back to thinking about this in terms of an invitation you get in the mail. Okay? Who is the invitation from? Okay, what are the first words of the invitation? Come unto me, or come to me. Who's the me there? The me is Jesus. How do we know the me is Jesus? Because Jesus had just been denouncing all the cities of Galilee and had then offered a prayer to the Father. And you get a little hint if you've got one of those Bibles that has the words of Jesus in red. Those words are still in red, right? When you get to come to me. So who's the invitation from? It is from Jesus. And by the way, it is from Jesus who had just experienced bitter disappointment, who's probably feeling the burden of that disappointment. And he's inviting. He's the one who's invited. So that's the from, okay? Now, what else is in an invitation? Who's it to, okay? It's to. Who did it get mailed to? Well, here's who it's sent to. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, okay? All you who are weary and burdened. When I learned it was all you who are laboring or heavy laden, right? But that's who he's invited. That's who the invitation is to, okay? Now, you think about, well, who are the burdened? Who are those that are bearing this burden, who are laboring, but they feel the weight of the burden that they're carrying? Well, in this culture, these are Jews. The gospel had not yet gone to the Gentiles, even though Jesus had encountered a Gentile just a couple chapters earlier, that centurion, more than a couple. But this is most likely Jews. Could be they're feeling the burden of the weight of trying to be saved by the law of Moses. Because what is the burden of being saved by a system of law? Being perfect, right? Being perfect. I don't know about you, but if you're trying to live to be perfect, that's going to feel like a big old burden. I mean, big. Because every day you're probably going to be reminded of, I can't do this, right? I can't do it. But it's also very likely that there are those who are beyond just feeling the burden of law or also feeling the burden of life. Because life is not always, fun and games. Life is not always, as I said in the lesson maybe last week, a couple weeks ago, it's not always mountaintop experiences, right? Jesus is feeling the weight of the burden of disappointment. And he's inviting those who also feel burdened, who also labor, to come to him. And I can't help but think about the prayer that he just prayed, where he thanked God, thank you for not entrusting to those who are wise in their own understanding, right? Thank you for entrusting this message to the little children. I think this invitation to, as the English Standard says, all who labor are heavy laden, as I learned it, I was about to go down a different road. But I think this is inviting the little children. I think the invitation is to the little children. These are folks who feel the burden of life or feel the burden of the weight of law or the weight of expectations, and they are in need, right? Mentally, physically, spiritually, they are in need. They're the little children that Jesus just prayed about. Again, how do I know that? Because of the context. Jesus, who just faced bitter disappointment, thanks God for not entrusting his gospel to those who don't believe they need it, but entrusting it to those who know they need it. And now he's saying to everybody, if you need it, come to me. If you need this, come to me. If you're feeling the weight of life, if you're feeling the weight of expectations, if you are feeling the burden, the mental burden of life, the physical burden of life, the spiritual burden of life, come to me. That's who it's addressed to. That's who it's addressed to, those who labor and are heavy laden. Now, how do you respond to this invitation? This would be, how do you RSVP? And not negatively, but positively. How do you accept this invitation? Okay? How do you accept the invitation? Well, he tells you in verse 29. He says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart. So he says, to accept my invitation to come to me, you have to take my yoke and put it on you. Okay? And he says later that my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, I'm not a farmer. I can't even pretend to be a farmer. My dad's family were farmers. On my mom's side, I've got a whole mess of cousins that are all cattle farmers. And I've been around that a little bit, but not enough to be able to speak about it intelligently. But I think I know what a yoke is. I think I know what a yoke is. A yoke is something that can, in this case, probably speaking of oxen, but that can be used to control oxen so that they can, what? They can perform the work that the farmer needs to have done, right? Pulling a plow, pulling a load, whatever. Okay, you guys that know more about farming than I do, tell me if I'm mistaken in that. But that's the way I understand. And I think maybe I'm assuming too much here. But I feel like most people, when they read that, are going to think about take my yoke upon you as looking at it from the angle of the system of control. You know, if a yoke is used to control animals, to subdue animals, to bend them to your will, they'll look at it from that angle. Now, is there an element of that here? Because ultimately, what is that a metaphor for? To become a disciple of Jesus, right? He is calling people to be his disciples, but he's describing it as a yoke. And so is there an element of that where you are yielding to the service of someone else? Of course there is. Of course there is. And I'm not going to try to paint it that that's not what it is. But who's the invitation written to? Those who are burdened, those who labor. And I take that as those who are feeling a burden that is too difficult for them to bear. Because otherwise, why would they be looking for something else, right? And so, yes, there is an element of this that is giving yourself in subservice to another, where you are willing to yield your rights to your life to someone else. Yes, there is an element of that. But I also choose to look at it the other way. What does a yoke enable an animal to do? To carry a burden that they otherwise could not carry, right? Am I wrong on that? Again, if you guys know more about this than I do, correct me, but that's my understanding. Is the yoke is not just to subdue an animal, but to allow them to pull something, to bear a burden, a load that they otherwise could not bear. Right? Who is Jesus writing this to or saying this to? Those who are burdened, who labor and feel this heavy burden. And what is he saying? You submit to me. You take my yoke upon you. I'm going to give you the ability to bear that burden. You with me? I'm going to give you the ability to bear that burden. Okay? And he describes it in this way. And here's kind of like the hook, right? If you're trying to invite somebody to a fundraising dinner, you say, well, hey, we're going to have such and such after dinner speaker, right? My high school, that after I graduated, they started doing all these fundraising dinners, and every year they'd have some sports celebrity to come and speak at their dinners, because otherwise no one's going to go if it's just, hey, come give us a bunch of money, right? No, it's no, 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 come here Peyton Manning, come here Archie Manning. We did that 2 years in a row. One year it was Steve Largent, a receiver for the Seahawks, who later became a senator, congressman, I can't remember. They had Philip Fulmer, they had Gene Stallings, they'd bring in all the, he said, had the speaker, come hear the speaker, pay $100 for a seat and dinner, you can hear the speaker, right? What are they trying to do? Raise money. But that's the hook, okay? The hook here is, what does he say? If you take his yoke, it's easy to bear. We'll come back and talk about that in a minute if we have time. But what's the hook? He says, I will give you what? Rest. I will give you rest. So he says, to those who are burdened, I will give you rest. And he says it two different times, okay? The first time, he says it in verse 28. He says, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest. And then again, he says it at the end of verse 29, after he says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly heart. And he says, you will find rest for your souls. By the way, I think there's a lot in that. I think there's a lot in that. I don't think this is a promise that the toil and the burden is going to go away. I don't think that's what this promise is about. I don't think the promise is about, hey, in this life, I'm going to take away all your toils and all your burdens. Because that would be inconsistent with the rest of the teachings of Jesus and his disciples. At least in this life. But I do think there is an element of this that's looking to the future. But I want you to think about a couple of things. One sense that Jesus is offering rest, especially to those who are under the weight of the expectations of the law of living perfectly, right? He says, I'm going to take that burden off of you. Why? Because Jesus has done all the work, right? He's done all the work to save us. So no longer are we being judged by a perfect standard. We're being judged through the lens of the blood of God Himself. Is that, in a sense, rest? Rest from the burden of being perfect? Yes. Think about the future. Does Jesus offer us a place of permanent rest in the glory with God? Absolutely. He offers us a way to live with Him forever. Again, who did the work? He did the work. He's just asking us to serve Him. But He did the work. Now, in that sense, does it make sense how Jesus says that His yoke is easy and His burden is light? If you compare trying to take on the yoke of perfection, of living a perfect life without exception, being trying to be found righteous by yourself, versus Jesus is calling you to join Him where He's already defeated sin. He's already defeated death. He has already defeated Satan. He's already done the work. He just asked you to follow Him. Does that not sound easier? Does that not sound easier than going down the path of I have to live a perfect life? I'm not getting anybody responding. Does that not sound easier than living, if the burden is I have to live a perfect life, being judged by a perfect standard? I want you to think about this also from another perspective. While we're here and now. The one thing coming to Jesus does is it gives life meaning. It gives life meaning. Again, I don't think Jesus is promising that your toil and your burden is going to go away. But if I know why I'm enduring toil and burden, does it not make it easier to bear the toil and the burden? We got a whole world out there that's trying to figure out what is this life about. Right. In 2024, I went to a bunch of concerts, not nearly as many as I did back pre-COVID when the kids were a lot smaller. But I went to a bunch of concerts. There was one concert I remember I went to where one of the songs of this group was literally titled, What's This Life For? One of their biggest songs that they sang. There's a lot of people trying to figure out what in the world are we here for? What's this life for? And if you live your life, the whole life, having no idea what it's for, just thinking that it's all random chance or that I have no idea why we're doing this, that's a burden. That's a burden. No matter what you're going through, it's a burden. So one of the ways I believe that Jesus offers rest is to give life meaning. We know why we're living this life, right? Whether our life ends tomorrow or 10 years from now or 50 years from now, we know why we're living this life, right? We're living it to serve Him and to be with Him forever. It gives meaning to life. Another side story, real quick. This week, I love documentaries. I love watching documentaries. Started watching this documentary about this guy who is he's a billionaire. He made his money in the tech industry. He's a billionaire. He's 45 years old, and he has made it for the last 5 years his life's mission to try and figure out how to live forever. And his entire existence from watching this documentary is everything he does every day is just to try to help him live a day longer. He gets up and for 4 hours he goes through light therapy. He gets like full body ultrasounds done. He has all these live-in clinicians. Full body ultrasounds, brain scans, blood work. He works out for 2 hours. He takes 100 supplement pills in the first 4 hours of his day. And then he allows himself to eat after those 4 hours. And by the way, he eats the exact same thing every day for every meal. And then after his meals, he goes through another routine that takes him until he goes to sleep, which is at 8:30. And so his entire life is nothing but how can I live one day longer? That's not what life is for. I was having a nervous breakdown watching what this guy does every day just so he can live another day. I don't want to feel that burden. The feeling like life is about nothing but trying to live a day longer. No, that's not what life is about. Jesus offers meaning to what life is all about. Is that not rest? Without Jesus, you can't know the Father. And without knowing the Father, you can't have meaning in this life. So it's a powerful invitation. Again, as Rex called it, the great invitation. I don't know if anybody else calls it that or not, but it is a great invitation. It's a great invitation. It's powerful. Rest from feeling the burden of perfection. I got to live a perfect life. Rest from the burden of having no idea what life's about or why I'm here. Rest from not knowing what my future after this life holds. Because my future is certain. Why? Because Jesus has already done it. And how do I accept it? I have to be willing to serve Him. And what does He promise me if I'm willing to serve Him? I'm going to help you bear that burden. I'm going to help you bear that burden. It's a great promise. If you're here tonight, you've never taken those first steps of putting the yoke of Jesus on your shoulders. Deciding I'm going to live for Him, being buried with Him in baptism, why not start that tonight? If there's anything we can do for you, please come while we sing our invitation song.